What makes a voice great? It's a question NPR is tackling in a year-long series called 50 Great Voices. We took your nominations and came up with a list. Some of the voices we'll profile are beautiful, some are soulful, and some just slap you across the face, as is the case with our first great voice. It's Iggy Pop. NPR's Robert Smith reports.
Okay, punk rock haters, put your earplugs in now. Iggy and the Stooges, 1973, sounds as nasty and as raw as it did almost four decades ago. I'm a street-walking cheetah with a hat full of napalm. I'm a runaway son of a nuclear A-bomb. I know you haters didn't actually put in your earplugs and you're probably writing complaint letters right now. Just know this, Iggy Pop still doesn't care what you think.
After how many years I've been doing this, I've never been willing to either bait myself or justify myself. I don't have to.
See, here's the thing. Up until the era of Iggy Pop and the Stooges, a great voice was usually one that charmed the audience, made the girls swoon or the men jealous. Iggy proved that a voice could be a weapon.
Let's hear it for the singer. I am the greatest.
On this cold Detroit night in 1974, Iggy is once again waging war using his vocal cords. Half of the audience worships him. The other half wants
Anybody
to kill him.
Tunes,
bottles and cups come hurtling out of the crowd.
Grenades, eggs, they want to throw at the stage. Come on.
Iggy doesn't remember a lot about that night. They were high on some hard drug or another. They'd been touring relentlessly for months.
It was just a big, heavy night. It was the Wild West.
Paper cups. Oh, my, we're getting violent.
Iggy had been punched out by bikers at a show the night before. And on this night, he had dared them to come back. And Iggy just stood there, bare-chested as usual, taunting the crowd. By the end, he wouldn't even play his own music. Iggy told the crowd he was going to do a 55-minute version of Louie Louie.
I never thought it'd come to this, baby!
It is a gorgeous, raw mess, a raunchy version of the classic that I can't play on the radio. So let's just skip to the end.
Thank you very much to the person who threw this glass bottle at my head. It nearly killed me, but you missed again, so you have to keep trying next week.
Sorry, suckers. There wasn't going to be a next week. The band broke up that night in 1974. The original punk rockers missed out on the worldwide punk revolution by a couple of years. Well, sort of. The Stooges' three albums and this final performance would be listened to over and over again by the guys who would later form the Sex Pistols, the Clash, the Ramones. The voice of Iggy Pop would be their muse. He made nothing seem more exciting than provoking a crowd to frenzy and mayhem. So where did Iggy learn this technique? Easy. Frank Sinatra.
I'll never forget riding in the back of my parents' Cadillac, and my father was singing along, fairy tales can come true, it can happen to you, if you're young at heart. And I thought, gee, I'd like to do that, you know.
It wasn't the tone, necessarily, that he wanted to imitate. It was the distinctiveness of the voice.
People tend to jump on the bandwagon, and the bandwagon at that time was like dumb. Members of the British yob classes growing their hair and butchering the American blues. Or quasi-classical adaptations in prog rock. Blah.
So were you sitting around going, I don't want to sound like that, I don't want to sound like that, I don't want to sound like that?
Yes, exactly. It was very important what not to do. It has to get up off the couch, walk around, and be original.
When the Stooges released their first album in 1969, they stripped away rock to the bare essentials. A couple of notes, a few chords, good to go.
No fun, my babe. No fun.
Iggy sang about suburban teenage hell, boredom and alienation.
No fun to hang around, feeling that same old way.
Iggy didn't follow that punk rock road, though. He got lost. Then he followed David Bowie to Berlin for the nightclubbing and Lust for Life eras. He dabbled in ska, new wave, finally recorded that album of standards he always wanted to do. But the spirit of the original Iggy lives on wherever bored teenagers gather to listen to painfully loud music. It's a Saturday afternoon, the all-ages punk rock show on the Lower East Side. Mohawks, leather jackets, singers without shirts diving into the crowd, and Iggy's there too, at least on the iPods. Milo Geary is 18 years old.
The sound of his voice is good because he's a lot slimier kind of than the stuff that was out like that. He was dirtier sounding, he was meaner, it was more authentic and unprofessional sounding.
Catch that? 40 years in rock music and you still get described by a teenager as authentic. Iggy endures. In fact, he's back on tour this summer. Still bares his chest, stage dives. At 62 years old, the voice is stronger than ever, but it is missing something.
The part you can't get is the attitude. I've got the same kid in me, but when he was ignorant, he was more compellingly dangerous vocally, and I can't quite get to that place.
So he'll have to settle for another kind of place. Iggy Pop and the Stooges will be inducted this year into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Bring on the bottles. Robert Smith, NPR News, New York.
The British soul singer and songwriter Corinne Bailey-Rae made a big splash when she debuted in 2006 with her single Put Your Records On. The album landed on the Billboard charts. It sold millions of copies. And Corinne Bailey-Rae earned a handful of Grammy nominations. Now she's back with her second album. It's called The Sea. Reviewer Tom Moon says this album is even more impressive than her debut.
When a young singer has a hit right out of the gate, the way Corinne Bailey-Rae did, you can usually guess what comes next. More of the same. It's understandable. These days, nobody in the music business likes to mess with success. That's one reason Bailey-Rae's follow-up is so interesting. It's hardly a replica of what worked last time.
Oh, you did it all again. You broke another skin. It's hard to believe this time. It's hard to believe that my heart's an open door.
Bailey-Rae's second effort is a massive leap forward. As a songwriter, she's taking on deeper, more serious subjects, and she's become an absolutely fearless singer. After her debut, Bailey-Rae was living the dream. She toured all over the world and collaborated with several of her idols, including legendary singer Al Green. Then, in early 2008, while she was working on this album, her husband died suddenly.
He's a real life wife. He's the best of his kind.
Bailey-Rae spent months in seclusion. She says that when she returned to work, she was surprised to discover that songs she completed before the tragedy still resonated. She'd already been writing about grief. The title track describes a canoeing accident in which Bailey-Rae's grandfather died. She pushed herself further in that direction, writing several songs that remember her late husband. This one's called Are You Here? Sadness runs throughout Bailey-Rae's second album. It even lurks between the lines of upbeat tunes that showcase her fierce, intensely rhythmic delivery. Are armchair pop culture psychologist will say that Bailey Ray's growth is the direct result of the death of her husband. That's an inevitable conclusion, but it shortchanges her. What I hear in her mesmerizing vocals and the album's delicate blend of jazz, soul, and pop is a profound artistic restlessness. She didn't just confront her grief. She pushed past whatever worked for her before, until she landed on a sound that's thrilling and at times even bold.
The new album from Corinne Bailey Ray is called The Sea. Our reviewer is Tom Moon. You can hear the entire album at npr.org.
So young.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You're hearing a recording of the Kiev Chamber Choir singing at the Cathedral of the Ascension in the Ukrainian capital. It's a timeless sound. It could come from the 14th century. And yet this piece was written just a few years ago, and it's a brand new recording, one of several new releases our classical music producer Tom Heisinger has been listening to these past few weeks, and Tom's in the studio with me. Good to have you back.
Great to be here, Guy.
So, Tom, before we get to some of the other new recordings you brought in today, let's start with this amazing piece we're hearing by the Kiev Chamber Orchestra.
It's by Valentin Silvestrov, who's in his early 70s, and he's a Kiev native. Early in his career, he was a very competent avant-gardist, and he had a change of heart in the 70s and became a little more spiritual, a little more romantic, more lyrical. And just a few years ago, he wrote a bunch of sacred music for this choir. And the great thing about it is the special effects that he gets. For one thing, he likes to set up these pieces antiphonally. So you have a single voice kind of emerging from the sonic ether that he creates by manipulating overtone singing and this very reverberant cathedral that they're in.
Tom, I was listening to this piece on my headphones last night, and it really took me back to a time when I covered Eastern Europe as a reporter, that sound of Orthodox churches.
It does, like you mentioned, it does have that timeless sound, and it is kind of like Brian Eno said about his ambient music. I find this as listenable as it is ignorable. So you can listen to it on headphones and really soak in all the odd and subtle effects that Silvestrov uses. And I was doing the dishes last night with it on in the background as a kind of sonic wallpaper.
It is a really magical sound, Tom. That's the Kiev Chamber Choir performing the music of Valentin Silvestrov. The album is called Sacred Works. Tom, let's move a bit south from Ukraine now, down to Ottoman Istanbul and a new record by the Spanish musician Jordi Savall.
Well, Guy, I have a prepared statement I would like to read.
Okay, please do.
Jordi Savall is a god. You know how you have these artists, maybe they're authors or movie stars or directors, that you're so in awe of their fierce intelligence that you practically worship them? Well, that's how I feel about Jordi Savall, who he's a guy, actually, who's best known for playing this antiquated old instrument called the viola da gamba, the precursor to our modern-day cello. And he plays a lot of Baroque music, Bach and some other unknown composers with his band, the Hesperian 21. But this new record is something that is a very far cry from Johann Sebastian Bach.
Tom, as you say, Jordi Savall is a composer and a musician who's really influenced by Baroque music, also by medieval music, primarily European music. What drew him to the music of the East, or what used to be called the Orient?
Well, he's always interested in facilitating these dialogues between Eastern and Western traditions. And for this new record, what better locale to focus on than Istanbul, which is a city that sits half, literally half in Asia and half in Europe. And for centuries, it's been this incredible melting pot of ideas and religions and art. And for this new record, he's gone back to this manuscript of 355 pieces collected by a guy named Kantemir, who was active in Istanbul in about 1700, who collected and codified what is essentially Ottoman classical music of the time.
So these are not original compositions by Jordi Savall?
No, these are compositions that date way, way back to the early 18th century. And it's just fascinating music, and it really moves out.
That's Jordi Savall leading his ensemble Hesperian 21 from his new album, Istanbul. NPR's classical music producer Tom Heisinger is in the studio with me, and he's playing some interesting new recordings that have crossed his desk recently. And Tom, I think we're already hearing the next piece you've picked.
It's by Ingram Marshall, who's in his early 60s, I think, about now. And it's September Canons is the name of the piece, and the record collects four works that span about 30 years of Ingram Marshall's composing career from 1972 to 2002. This music we're hearing now is Marshall's Lament on the September 11th attacks. Mm. But if you come to the piece without knowing that fact, like I did, I just threw it in the CD player and thought, wow, this is a great piece from Ingram Marshall I haven't heard before. I think it works perfectly, powerfully on its own.
It seems like there's some electronic processing going on here in this piece.
Absolutely. Marshall composes for normal symphony orchestras and everything, but he also embraces like new technology. So this piece is scored for amplified violin, just wonderfully played by Todd Reynolds in this recording, and then digital delays, digital loops, and processing. So even though it sounds like it has a big body of strings in it, these are all processed strings. And I love how the piece just kind of rises and falls throughout its 13 minutes. It's very hard to excerpt it, really. You need to let the whole piece wash over you. But Todd Reynolds' violin soars, keeps soaring higher with these plucked notes. And then at one point, everything falls away and kind of falls back to earth. And then later there's a segment where tons of these little plucked notes start falling like shards of music back to the ground. It's quite stunning, actually. Mm. Very powerful music, I think.
That's violinist Todd Reynolds performing in a piece called September Canons, composed by Ingram Marshall. Tom, let's take a listen to something else you brought in. When I heard this, I thought, Schubert.
That's right. It is Schubert. Really great melody there, one of his impromptus, and it's played by Imogen Cooper, a British pianist. She gave a number of all Schubert recitals at the South Bank Center in London, and they put them on CD. It's a two CD set, and she plays some of Schubert's shorter pieces and a couple of his major late career sonatas, and she plays them to perfection, I think.
Obviously, thousands of Schubert recordings. What makes this unique? What's so different about Cooper's recording?
To me, she's a natural Schubert player, and one of the reasons is because she came to Schubert through his songs. He wrote 600 songs, and Cooper has accompanied many great Schubert leader singers, especially Wolfgang Holzmeier. So she has a mainline right into that lyric part, that songful part of Schubert, and also the bittersweet part also. So she really makes that piano sing.
Tom, we have time for one more, and I begged you to bring this in because the story is so unbelievable.
Okay, well, you remember the guy who wrote Peter and the Wolf, right? Sergei Prokofiev. Well, this is Sergei Prokofiev's grandson, Gabriel Prokofiev, who is a performer, a DJ, a composer.
A DJ and composer.
And composer. He's a classically trained composer, and he has written a concerto for turntables and orchestra for the London-based artist called DJ Yoda.
Tom, I just gotta wonder what Grandpa Sergei would think. Classical music on ecstasy?
Well, it's a collision of sorts, I guess, between hip-hop and classical, but it's really not that much different, if you think of it, than Joseph Haydn, who wove in a Croatian folk song at the end of his 104th symphony. It's a contemporary composer working with a tradition and working with contemporary music.
With DJ Yoda.
Yes. I think it works.
That's NPR's classical music producer, Tom Heisinger. He pops into our program from time to time to share some of the new recordings that cross his desk. You can hear all of the pieces we've discussed. They're at our website, nprmusic.org. Tom, I think I'm going to crank up the bass on this new Prokofiev.
Go for it, guy.
And for Sunday, that's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Thanks for listening, and have a great week.